bring to our first keynote speech of the day. As Andrew was saying before, fortunately for him, Andy and his wife had twins yesterday. Unfortunately for us, that means he can't be here because he's with the twins and his wife, but we send him all good wishes. But Lisa's agreed to have some time, more time with questions and answers. So we're just going to have the one keynote presentation this morning. So let me introduce Lisa, first of all. So our first keynote speaker for the day is Associate Professor Lisa Whelan from the University of Melbourne. And Lisa worked in adult education for 9 years. And has more recently, for the last 17 years, been working in higher education. So has a huge amount of experience, cross-sector experience, in our areas of interest. So we're delighted that Lisa's come all this way from Melbourne to spend some time here and to talk to us today about the work she's been doing. And we're delighted to welcome you to our conference. So, Lisa.
Martin Trow, who was a United States scholar, New using his framework, his extraordinary and prescient framework that he developed in the early 1970s, of tracked, mass and unified tertiary education systems, even if I don't agree with his conclusions, which I don't. I'll look at why it's changing and what's happening as a consequence. Okay, broadly speaking, there are two ways of organising tertiary education systems. There's the differentiated systems that we see in Northern Europe, and then there's the more unified systems that we see in Anglophone liberal market economies. Now, in Northern Europe, where they have separate vet and higher education sectors, which are deeply separate, deeply tracked, what they also have is relatively stable labour market destinations for graduates from each of those sectors. So they're quite different destinations that they end up in. And that means that the graduates from those sectors draw from a differentiated knowledge base that's provided in each sector. The other thing that happens is that the economies are managed, sort of, in a bad way, by social partnerships, which include business, labour, government, and in terms of the education systems, the educational institutions. And that tends to match graduates to jobs, you know, in a sort of broad sense. In contrast, in the Anglophone liberal market economies, they're much more fluid. Knowledge and skills changes a lot more, so you don't get the deep investment in manufacturing and technology that you find in Northern Europe. Employers need industry-specific knowledge, but they also need broader knowledge and skills and a less differentiated knowledge base. And in Anglophone liberal market economies, the market is used as the main mechanism to match graduates and jobs, and that means they have to have the knowledge to compete with each other in that labour market. Australia is a bit of an anomaly, I suspect. I won't go into all the historical reasons why that's the case, but we have a liberal market economy, but we have a differentiated tertiary education system in a relatively undifferentiated labour market. That is, we have two sectors, a vet sector and a higher education sector, and they are quite differently tracked sectors, but we don't have a tracked school system. Our school systems are still unified. In higher education, we have 37 public universities and two private universities, sort of, and a couple of hundred small private providers. We have, of that 37, five are called dual sector universities, and that is that they have a big TAFE division and a big higher education division, so they've got both the sectors in the one institution. There's 1.35 million students, but about 813,000 equivalent full-time student load, you know, so 50 full-time students. 96% is delivered in publicly funded universities. In vocational education and training, we have 59 TAFEs that deliver 1,300 campuses across Australia. About 620 other government providers, for example, neighbourhood houses, things like that. But we have 5,000 providers in total, 5,000. We have 1.7 million students, which works out to 610,000 training equivalents. TAFE, the public provider, teaches about 75% of the students, but it does 84% of all the teaching. But the most startling thing for me is that the biggest 100 providers, 100, do 95% of all the teaching. So that means that 2% do 95% of all the teaching, 98% of the institutions do 5% of the teaching, and so what this has meant is we've had to establish this enormously difficult regulatory framework to account for the 2% who sometimes do the wrong thing. We have a differentiated curriculum in both sectors, so that in higher education we have a curriculum or input knowledge-based curriculum, but in vocational education we have competency-based training. That is, curriculum that is based on specifying, industry-specified descriptions of workplace tasks and roles. Now, for those of you who understand national vocational qualifications in England and Scottish vocational qualifications, they're identical. But the thing is that is the only publicly funded qualification in our vet sector. That's it. That's it. So that gives you some idea of the arguments we have. Okay, so we think we're entering, as research, into the third wave of higher education expansion since the Second World War in Anglophone countries. Now, Now, in the first period, in the 1950s and 1960s, we saw, for example, the establishment of new universities in England and the rest of the UK, and new universities in Australia, but also other higher education institutions. So you had polytechnics in the UK, and we had colleges of advanced education in Australia. The US system, which has community colleges and universities, had just got bigger. So that system just grew. The second period of expansion was in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and that was through the creation of a unified university system. So England merged its polytechnics with its universities, and we merged our CAEs with our universities. The English system just got, the American system just got bigger. New Zealand stayed a bit different. It still has polytechnics. The Canadian system, it was sort of like the American system, and it just got bigger. Now, the third period is in the early 2000s, and where it's commenced, and this is happening through the second vocational tier of tertiary education. So we have the special mission of further education colleges in the UK to widen access to higher education through foundational degrees and higher national diplomas, if it's here. So, and in Scotland, further education plays a big role in delivery of higher education, about 25% of all higher education through their colleges. In the United States, 15 to 17 of their states, have authorised their community colleges to offer full degrees, four-year baccalaureate degrees, and not just two-year associate degrees, which is what they traditionally do. They have to have a vocational focus, and they have to meet a workforce need. In New Zealand, their polytechnics offer degrees around productive capability. Canada, three of their provinces have approved their community colleges to offer full degrees. And in Australia, our public sector TAFEs are starting to offer degrees now. It's very nascent provision, but it's going to grow. And private providers are also starting to fill that space. Now, the rationale in every case, in every country, is that this provision has a more vocational and applied focus, and it's better able to meet industry needs. It also, the other rationale is it's able to support guiding participation in higher education through a much more supportive pedagogy. Now, in Australia, there's two of our eight, we have more federation, we have eight states. Two of our states have mapped a public policy role for TAFE in expanding access to higher education and tertiary education plans, but no money. So, you know, no money. So the most disadvantaged have to pay full fees. Okay, so how can we think about this? Well, Martin Trower, 1974, published a very famous article, and he revisited it in 2005, and it really actually is quite extraordinary. He said that an elite higher education system, remember community colleges in the US are part of their higher education system, so it'll be sort of like including our FAs and our TAFEs, that an elite system has up to 15% participation in higher education, mass system between 16 to 50%, and a universal system 50% and above. The purpose of an elite system is to prepare the social elite for leadership. The nature of the curriculum is that it shapes mind and character. It has a highly structured academic, professional and academic knowledge structure with strong boundaries between the institution and society. So, for example, in Cambridge, I don't know if it's across the board, but certainly in education, if they go to Homerton College, they have to spend the first year on campus, living on campus. A mass system, purpose is to prepare a segment of the population for a much broader range of technical and economic leadership roles. The curriculum becomes more fuzzy, modular, semi-structured, and the boundaries between the institution and society start to break down. And this is to train experts for a broader range of elite occupations in technical and economic roles. Now, this type of provision begins so that the technical and the vocational purpose of higher education begins as a dominant framework, begins its ascendancy over the liberal and general purposes of education after World War II. That's when we start to see the domination of that agenda. The purpose of a universal system is to prepare the whole population for rapid social and technological change in advanced industrial society. The boundaries between knowledge and everyday knowledge of institution and society break down. And while this is responding to external market imperatives, it's not tied directly to this or that job. Basically, you're saying the population needs to be educated if you're going to have a society that's able to manage the change, not that they have to have skills for the engineering industry. So it's a different sort of notion. Now, the curriculum is much broader, and it's not tied to anything necessarily, but so while it's for broad purposes of vocational, it's a broad understanding of what vocational means. Now, there was a lot of criticisms of Trout. His system, his typology was regarded as very Anglo, which it probably is in terms of the Anglophone countries, didn't reflect Europe, and that it didn't foresee the pace of change and that it was too sequential. Now, when he revisited his typology in 2005, he said, well, some of this is probably right. But instead of seeing it necessarily as a strict sequential development, it's better to see his typology as an analytical framework which allows you to understand the structure of tertiary education systems. So he said that actually what happened when the mass system emerged is the elite system didn't go away. It just got absorbed in as one component of the mass system. When the universal system emerged, the mass and universal bits didn't go away. They stayed with, they became part of the one system. So the university that I was at before this was a university that was established in the 1970s, middle wage, middle class, middle status university, part of the mass system. I worked at a newer university before that, which would be regarded as part of a universal system. Now, the problem is that Trout thought all this was good and necessary, and that's where I disagree. I don't think you need to have, I don't think you should have a system where some get more than others. It's a question of distributional justice. So the broad drivers for these changes, there's broad drivers which are challenging two divides. The divide between sectors and the divide between public and private institutions. Now, the reason why this is happening is that most advanced, wealthy, industrial countries are trying to increase the percentage of the population with tertiary education qualifications. It's not necessarily the case for poorer countries where the issue for them still is universal secondary education. One of our leading researchers argues that there's an inexorable trend towards greater proportions of the workforce at informal and higher level qualifications. It's a process of credentialism that's been happening for a number of years. Now, the other thing is that an increasing number of jobs require degrees as entry-level qualifications, so that those jobs that require, say, diplomas before now require degrees. And that is happening across the board. So what we have in Australia is we have diploma and degree graduates competing for the same jobs. Degree graduates win. However, diploma graduates still do better than Vic graduates in lower-level qualifications. So, this is all, got to keep this in proportion. So in Australia, the importance of the diploma England, the importance of foundation degrees, and in Scotland, the importance of higher national diplomas entry-level qualifications to work is declining, but its importance as a transitional qualification to higher education is increasing. And in Australia, I would argue that the diploma for us is the key equity qualification in the whole sector, because what we have to do in Australia, our challenge is to get our students from disadvantaged backgrounds out of lower level certificates where they are languishing and just perpetual churn and into diplomas as a basis for getting better jobs but as also as a basis for going on to higher education. The other thing is that in Anglophone countries, unlike Northern Europe, there's a loose fit between labour market destinations and the qualifications that people except for the regulated occupations. So if you're trained to be a doctor, you usually end up being a doctor. So where you have regulated occupations where it takes a long time to train, like in the trades, electrical trades or something like that, you end up usually in that occupation. However, overall, only 30% of our VET graduates, 30%, end up in jobs that are directly associated with their qualification. And yet they are trained for specific workplace tasks and roles. Now, to me, that seems a bit stupid. VET, arguably, and TAFE will need to offer high-level qualifications if it is to fulfil its traditional role of preparing people for middle-level skilled occupations, because those are the occupations that now require degrees. But for me, the key thing is that you cannot sustain an argument for curricular differentiation, competency-based training in one sector, curriculum knowledge-based curriculum in the other sector, when the labour market destinations are exactly the same. It removes any economic basis, if there ever was one, for competency-based training. These changes are inexorable. The other thing that's driving changes in Australia is, and also I think Australia is leading the pack, is the market. Our governments are much more thoroughly marketised. Our tertiary education systems, I can talk at great length about that and the things that have happened as a consequence. Also, we have equity and expansion targets. So government, like the UK in 1997, when you had the election of the Blair New Labour government, we had a Labour government that was elected a few years ago, we now have a minority Labour government, we have equity targets and expansion targets for the system. Now that means in tertiary education that fulfilling the higher level targets requires fulfilling the lower level targets, because you need to have a more qualified pool of applicants that you can draw upon. So it means the sectors actually have to work together and pathways have to be at the centre of it, whether you like it or not. So what we're finding is the sectors that are increasingly sectors that are increasingly defined by the qualifications that are accredited in each, not necessarily by the institution in which they're offered. Now we shall just skip over this next one. So what we've got at the moment in Australia is we have 90 institutions. I won't tell you how hard that is to find out. I actually wrote an article for our campus ran in which the word murderous was in the headline in terms of the difficulties in trying to find this information. So we have now 90 institutions, and that includes 22 self-accredited institutions. That's 16 universities that are also registered as vet providers or have a separate company that is a vet provider, but they don't have much. Then we have the 5 dual sector universities, and the other one is the Bachelor Institute of Indigenous Tertiary Education in the Northern Territory. We have 68 non-self-accredited institutions, and this includes 11 of our 59 TAFEs. However, our TAFEs are organised in different ways in different states, and in one of those TAFEs includes the whole New South Wales system, because it's a much more centralised system, so that's 10 TAFEs in that system. So they're now, so actually well over 20 TAFEs are registered to do this. We've got more dual sector universities that are coming on the scene. We're going to have another one in Central Queensland, and we might have one between the University of Canberra and Canberra Institute of Technology, because they've been told by the government that they've got to merge. However, and they're going to get married. However, as the director of the Canberra Institute of Technology, the TAFE, said, you usually date first. And there hasn't been too much of that. Okay, so what we're seeing is one sector that's emerging, but it is more hierarchical and stratified. Students, when we interviewed them in both the TAFEs, higher ed students in the TAFEs, and also students in both VET and higher ed students in private providers, higher ed students are absolutely enthusiastic about their program and the teachers. They emphasise to them the importance of smaller classes, more supportive pedagogy, and many contrasted the experience they had in TAFE as being lost at university because they were just one of hundreds, whereas in TAFE they're in much smaller classes. They knew their teachers' names. Teachers knew their names. You've got no idea how important it was that teachers knew their name. That was a key thing for them. And they formed a tight community within their program. It was as if the rest of the college didn't exist. The only thing for them was their music program or, their accounting program or whatever it was. Now, we heard the same complaints from them. We asked them, what should we do to improve the vision? How can we make it better? And we heard the same things. Essays are agony. We hate writing essays. Referencing is just the pits. It's shopping. And why can't lecturers get their act together and actually stage the timing of their assessment tasks and not have them all at the one time? Now, you hear that everywhere. Every university, you hear that. But the difference is, in this case, you're dealing with students with much more vulnerable identities as higher education students who don't necessarily have the same level of academic preparation. So perhaps these issues actually require us to be more focused on that sort of thing for them. Now, for many of these students, particularly the younger students, we spoke to a fair few younger students, the fact that they were higher education students wasn't a taking for granted given. For them, the issue wasn't do they do dentistry or medicine. The issue for them was do they do higher education or not. And many of them relied on the speakers of others in order to make that decision. We asked them how would they describe themselves. What do they tell people they do when people ask? And they weren't really forthcoming that they studied at TAFE. Some said they studied at unis, others said they studied at colleges. If you ask students at my university, which is a lit university, what do you do? They say, I study at the University of Melbourne. They don't say, I study music, I study at college, I study, or anything like that. We had one associate degree student said that she told people she's associate degree, she's a junior degree, short cycle. She says she's studying half a degree. She tells people she's studying half a degree. And she says, because if she says she's studying an engineering degree, they go, oh. And she says, no, it's okay, it's only half a degree. Another one tells students that, I tell them the name of the qualification, they're usually blinded by the big words, so you can see there's really quite a lot of uncertainty here. Now, teachers supported higher education more than management, if that was possible, because their management did support it. Their problem was that management didn't do a good enough job on supporting it, and that they didn't understand it. But they did argue that higher ed was more rigorous, based on scholarship compared to VET, and that, they had problems in making the head shift when they were required to go from teaching competency-based qualifications to higher education qualifications. We also asked them the same question, what do you tell people you do? And a lot of them didn't say that they would have kids. They would, as you can see here, we're never sure what to call ourselves. We're new. But also, we're trying to differentiate ourselves. It's all about people. There's no room for green academics without people skills. So you can see that there's a, on the one hand, an identification, but on the other hand, a differentiation. Now, in terms of institutions, what we found were TAFEs and private providers that wished to change their sector designation from being TAFE or a private provider into being a tertiary education institution or a university college or a polytechnic. We didn't come across a single university that wanted to change its sector designation. So you can see that there is a sort of bit of institutional aspiration there. All institutional leaders, teachers, students, compare their provision to the gold standard of universities, but they also differentiate it. This is how we are different. So the structure of the sector divide is actually quite important. It will exist. We can't pretend it doesn't exist. And if we do, it will only re-emerge itself in pernicious ways. Okay, so just in conclusion, we have a new tertiary education sector that's emerging, but it is more hierarchical and stratified. There are potential for new forms of inequality. The issue so much isn't do students attend higher ed or not, it's the type of access that they have. We have a discourse of social inclusion around this provision, but it doesn't actually look at the outcomes. We don't have a discourse around social justice, and they are quite different because social justice is about distributive justice. I think TAFE, VET needs to offer higher ed roles to maintain its traditional roles. Otherwise, it's going to become residual. And how the sectoral divide is drawn is very important. If we just move it down, it's going to actually make it harder for the equity groups to get out of the lower level growth. And we need to think about mission groups so that we can support. And our biggest challenge, I think, is to build the capacity of our institutions to support new, hitherto marginalised students and how we apply it.
We've got time for some questions, some comments, some debates, some arguments, some disagreements, some agreements, whatever you like, it's up to you. So just say who you are and where you're from, please. So who wants to kick off? I think there's a question here.
Hi, I'm Brian Watson, University of Waikato, New Zealand.
Okay.
This from across the ditch.
Yes, across the ditch, that's how we describe it.
I agree with you about the differentiation, particularly in the case of New Zealand.
Yeah.
Actually, I work in a college, the Waikato Pathways College of the University, directly, and it's in the cusp in this differentiation. And since I've had the job, I've been pressurised to basically kind of withdraw services so that the Polytech can take over. The government policy is really that Polytech should be doing this kind of stuff, not the universities.
Yeah, that's
right. So it's been one constant battle to retain it. I wanted to ask you about how research has entered into this agenda. I noticed that I don't think you mentioned the word research. In terms of the differentiation.
Oh, okay, yes, good question.
My experience is that, that basically research is what drives universities primarily. The other things I'd like to get some comment from you about mature age students.
Yeah.
What's happening to them in this new agenda? Because I think in the case of New Zealand, they're now being squashed out of the market, whereas before they were actively encouraged.
Just on the research, that's a good question. We have this debate. Well, I mean, what we're having at the moment as a debate in Australia is do all universities have to be research institutions? Now, the thing is, I keep saying to the TAFE institutes, they're never going to win in a research fight. You know, it's not fair, it's not just, but that's the way it is. Okay, so they have to actually develop an approach that deals with that. So I think that our TAFEs shouldn't try to get into the big R research because they're not going to win. But we must not surrender on the question of scholarship. And unless we differentiate between research and scholarship, we haven't got an argument for that government needs to invest in the development of scholarship in these institutions. If we collapse the two, people say, no, you don't do that. You know, you don't do research. But if we separate and make a distinction between research and scholarship, we have a much better argument to say you've got to invest in developing this so that our students have the same level of sort of private experience. But the other thing, which is sort of to go off on a tangent, which I won't do for too long, is I actually think there is a role for TAFEs, polys, FE colleges in innovation, and that is in knowledge transfer in workplaces, because that's actually how innovation occurs, not necessarily through R&D, because actually TAFEs know more about what happens in workplaces. On mature age students, I think that differs by country. That is a question of government policy. Ours is trying to get adults qualified. The problem in Australia is we have a booming economy. We actually have a two-track economy. We have boom states, which are digging up the ground and exporting it all to China, and that's why Australia survived the global financial crisis, and the other states aren't doing so well. But they're trying to get everyone educated and in the job. So I think it does depend on the country, the economy, the policy, how they're going to allocate the resources and that sort of thing.
Just a reminder as well, when this mentioned Martin Trowe. Martin Trowe spoke at a FACE conference a long time ago now, where he discussed these books, so there's a real connection between your work and what Martin was talking to us about those many years ago. Next question is Jeff, in front.
Jeff Bray, Head of Academic Partnerships at the University of Derby in the Midlands of England. And really it's a question about partnerships.
Yeah.
The emphasis clearly in Australia is on a differentiated system.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered whether that inhibits completely, partially, or not very much the transitional partnerships between vocational education and higher education in the way that we have those partnerships here for top-up purposes and for transition between further education and vocational higher education.
That's also an excellent question. It's a really complex question, as it is everywhere. The government has this amazingly naive belief, isn't that surprising? That you can have a deeply differentiated track curriculum but have massive levels of articulation of student pathways at the same time. And so government policy has always been to have heaps of pathways, always. And they're always complaining that there's not enough. We've got a new Australian Qualifications Framework which is coming into being on July 1, and that's going to help us because what that says is that every single qualification, with the exception of the doctorate qualification, has to provide students with the knowledge and skills to study at the next level. So that's going to help. Now, just on partnership, it depends if it's a selective university. No, why do they need it? You know, if it's a recruiting university, which the rest are, the rabble of the rest, then yes, they do need it. And so some are better at it than others. So that the university that I was at last time, Griffith University, we have a colleague here from Griffith who'll be able to talk about this sort of stuff as well. It had an excellent approach to the development. So we had MOUs, we had governance arrangements, we had what we call boundary spanners, that is people who are culturally literate in both sectors. We've got to have that. If we don't have that, it doesn't work. And we had plans for what we wanted to do. Now, in a lot of other places, it's completely haphazard. But we make the mistake. I've been doing this institutional stuff for years, I don't just do research, I actually have to do this stuff. We make the mistake of trying to think that we should have a pathway for every single qualification. We shouldn't. We should only try and develop pathways where the traffic is the greatest. We need to have in institutional arrangements strategies that go good governance and strategies that go from cheap to expensive. And you need to have a strategy. I mean, that's the point. So the idea is you can't just say we've got to play nicely together. You've got to have management commitment in both institutions. And often where management does make that commitment, the problems come further down. So the key thing is you're not going to get pathways unless you get teachers in the two sectors knowing each other. And policy tends to forget this little fact. They think that because, we say we have these outcomes, everyone trusts these outcomes. Well, no, they don't. So they only trust the outcomes when they know each other and when they have trust and confidence in the syllabus assessment and teaching and learning processes. So that's why actually institutional policy shouldn't just be focused on some good, mature outcomes with ours. The actual thing should be to build relationships between teaching staff.
Lots of nods on that one. I think a lot of us involved in these things recognise how important that is and how often it's ignored. I have a question. I think Mike's got a question in the middle there.
Michael from the University of Glasgow. Lisa, I wonder if you can tell us whether things have improved in terms of the transitions that occur into your sector institutions.
Oh, yes.
Because I remember your work from some years ago where you were saying, in essence, despite the fact that field sector institutions have been created, there were internal boundaries inside those institutions which have, in many cases, been overcome.
Which had not been overcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I've probably changed my position on this a little bit, which is interesting, which you should never admit as a researcher. Yes, they have. They've doubled the percentage of students they admit on the basis of private studies. They admit twice as many students on average as the rest of the sector. So they have done a great job. Swinburne University of Technology admits 27% of its students on the basis of its private qualifications. The dual sector universities. So what we have in dual sector universities are teaching is sectorally differentiated. Higher ed teachers teach higher ed, TAFE teachers teach TAFE. That's breaking down completely for a whole lot of reasons. Some of them to do with funding, get more money to teach more higher ed. So let's get our TAFE teachers to teach it. That sort of thing. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to actually actively, every single one of them, put in place processes to deal with the sector divide. Now, in some cases, I think they're doing the wrong thing. They're trying to say, look, it doesn't really exist. It's just all in the culture, it doesn't really exist. And that's a mistake, because as long as there are two external sectors that are funded at different levels, hierarchically related, different levels of status, the sector divide will emerge whatever you do. And what we're finding in our TAFEs is that it's emerging in our TAFEs, even though they said, oh, we're never going to have the problems of the dual sectors. So I think what they actually need to do is to put in place mechanisms for transition, mechanisms to support not only students, but also staff. And one university, Charles Darwin University, has actually created a single classification for the staff. Got no idea how they did it. Got no idea how they got the unions to agree to it. But they have. So I think they're making enormous progress, but it can't be on the basis of let's just pretend it's not there. It's got to be what can we do to negotiate.
If it's quick, we've got time, I think, for one more question. Who's got a quick question and then we'll make? Right at the back.
Hi,
Dan
McCann, Chief Executive of Open College Network in London. with the increase of student fees now in the UK to 9,000, the government said that they will be opening up the market to more private universities. And we're already seeing some American universities, corporations, going for the degree of universities in the UK. My question is, what's going to happen to wider participation? Because any profit motivated university is going to concentrate very much on employment skills, vocational and skills of that kind. But the whole purpose of a university was also about enlightenment and developing people and confidence building. Does that mean the future people from disadvantaged backgrounds and wider participation in the rush now for private funding will be left behind and be worse off than they were 20 years ago?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. If you have a look at the US and the University of Phoenix, for example, where they've actually been in big trouble because they've been involving heaps of working class students with outrageous fees, which I'll never have been able to pay back. That's a clear example of that. What we've found in Australia is that markets lead to more regulation. So the more marketised it becomes, the more regulated it becomes. And we've had some very bad experiences. International education is the third biggest export market Australia's got. It's been completely trashed. So all of brand Australia has been affected by the market. And that's because we had a small number of very bad private providers doing very bad things. That's one factor. And also it grew exponentially with all sorts of quality problems. So what they've found in Fed is that this has affected the whole tertiary education system. We've also found in Victoria where they're opening up the public, they've made all qualifications completely contestable, all qualifications. So in the space of one quarter this year compared to the first quarter last year, private students in private providers grew by 114%, and the amount of teaching they did grew by 150%. TAFEs grew by 10% in comparison. The share of the public sector fell by about 15%, the total share. So they haven't opened the business, obviously. In higher ed, what they're doing is that they're not opening up the public funding, although they're making it easier for private providers. They're not opening up the public funding because they're very worried that they're going to have the same problems. But what they will do is, as soon as they get the regulations in place, they will. So what you find is, markets which are supposed to be free and create free movement for all actually lead to increasing amounts of regulation and thumb screwing. So that's the consequence.
Okay, again, I think some salutary comments there for people in the UK to think about as we move in a similar direction. All right, so we're going to have to stop there. But can you join with me and thank Lisa again for